Today on Against the Grain, Latin America has played a crucial role for the United States as an empire. And historian Greg Grandin argues that Latin America's importance stretches well beyond the regional interests of the United States in the Western Hemisphere. Instead, Grandin posits, the countries south of the border have been used as a crucible for the formation of American policy, such as applying the lessons from counterinsurgency against the left in El Salvador and Colombia to the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Twice last century, in the 1900s, the United States turned to Latin America to regroup following systemic global crises. So writes Greg Grandin in his classic book, newly revised, Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Making of an Imperial Republic. One of those moments was during the Great Depression, and the other was in the 1980s, when the New Right, helmed by the likes of Jean Kirkpatrick and other neoconservatives such as Elliot Abrams, who had come to prominence again during the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Grandin argues that, paradoxically, Latin American resistance to U.S. domination has had surprisingly beneficial consequences for the U.S. as an empire. He's professor of history at Yale University and won the Pulitzer Prize last year for The End of the Myth. Greg, broadly speaking, how important has Latin America been for the United States as an imperial power?
It's been critically important. I think that its importance is unacknowledged in a profound sense, and that in many ways is the larger point of the book. It's easy to talk about Latin America as a site in which the U.S. Imposes its imperial will, carries out coups and regime changes, and pays no attention to the consequences, to disastrous results. But more important, or at least there's another story to tell, and that's the way Latin America serves to kind of socialize the United States in many ways. I mean, Latin America was a challenge to the founders of the United States. They immediately had to deal with the fact that the Western Hemisphere was filled up with multiple republics, and they shared with the founders of the United States a sense of American exceptionalism. And I think that Latin America is kind of the missing ingredient when all of the discussions about what is and isn't exceptional about the United States is its relationship with Latin America. And I think that that relationship is two things. On the one hand, Latin America, just the fact that it constantly has resisted and pushed back against U.S. expansion in ways that, say, European empires prior to the collapse of Spain and England in the Western Hemisphere, or indigenous communities, couldn't. Latin America, as sovereign modern nations, were able to resist and push back ideologically, economically, and politically. And that pushback had a way of forcing the United States to figure out new strategies on how to project its power. So it had this enormous, on the one hand, it socialized the United States and restrained the United States, and to use a word that's often used with U.S. foreign policy, but in the opposite direction, it contained the United States. On the other hand, at the same time, it also was this place where, and this is one of the overarching arguments of the book, where ascendant political coalitions within the United States used to work out their worldview and their tactics and to reconcile contradictions among different constituencies. And that, I think, is something that is absent from most discussions of the relationship of Latin America to the United States. It's easy to talk about Latin America as this place of where the U.S. empire has run roughshod. It's much more difficult to understand the way Latin America has shaped the domestic politics of the United States. And that's one of the things that I hope to do in this book.
One of the things that you do in Empire's Workshop is argue that In two periods following major crises for the United States and really crises of global capitalism, that Latin America was used by the U.S. state to shift orientation, shore up political alliances, and in some ways work out the mess of the crisis that it was in. And the first of those moments was with FDR and the New Deal in the 1930s. What compelled the U.S. state under FDR to change its orientation to Latin America at that time, and what consequences did it have for political alliances in the U.S.?
Yeah, and that is, again, just that's the focus of the book, the way Latin America serves as this crucible for political realignment in the United States. And the book does look at the New Deal with FDR and the New Right. But in terms of the New Deal, if you think of the period prior to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's election in 1932, if you start that period, say, in 1898, when the U.S. Basically leaped into territorial empire. I mean, you know, we could have discussions about definitions, and obviously the expansion across the continent was, and the taking of Texas and the third of Mexico was a territorial empire. But really, the landing of troops in Puerto Rico and Cuba and the Philippines and the annexing of Puerto Rico and the annexing of the Philippines and turning Cuba into a neo-colony was a kind of qualitative jump. And from 1898 to 1933, what the United States witnessed in the Caribbean basin was a kind of radicalization of a region that's in some ways analogous to the Middle East, where serial interventions didn't secure U.S. power, but actually led to a hemorrhaging of U.S. power. And waves of radicalization, growing, I think this word is questionable, anti-Americanism. I think using that phrase, anti-Americanism, obscures the content of the critique, but setting that criticism aside, I'll use the word anti-Americanism. So waves of anti-Americanism throughout Latin America. And of course, 1929 was the collapse of the stock market and the beginnings of the Great Depression. So there was this enormous, not only on the one hand did you have these serial interventions, military interventions in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic, in Nicaragua, in Cuba, in Mexico, that led to the opposite of the projection of U.S. power. It led to a kind of deflation of U.S. power in many ways. And and then on the other hand, you had this great economic contraction with the Great Depression. So the election of Roosevelt in 1932 and his inauguration in early 1933 really was a kind of classic political realignment. And by that, I'm using a phrase that's a concept that's often used by political science to talk about the history of the United States. Think about the history of the United States as a succession of political coalitions within the two-party system. So aside from the Civil War, for the most part, political conflict is contained within the two-party system through these political realignments. So as times change, as politics change, as economics change, it can no longer be contained or be worked out through the existing two-party system and the ideas and the relationships which uphold that system, there's this realignment. And obviously the New Deal and the developmentalism and the expansion of the federal government that the New Deal implied, and the reorientation of what it meant to be citizen, and what citizenship meant to include a notion, a fairly robust notion of social citizenship, was what marked the New Deal from the previous period. But in terms of foreign policy, FDR is known for the famous phrase, good neighbor policy, which he used for the first time in his inauguration, in his March 1933 inauguration. But he wasn't referring specifically to the Latin America when he said, in the realm of foreign affairs, this nation is dedicated to being a good nation. He was talking about the world in general. But he only really dedicated a a few sentences to foreign policy in that inauguration, because obviously there was a domestic crisis that superseded any concern for foreign policy in 1933. But the fact is that in most of the rest of the world, FDR was cut off, right? Militarism was on the rise in Asia. There was European states carved out colonial realms. There was fascism, also on the rise in Europe. So in many ways, Latin America was the only region where the U.S. had access to. So FDR turned to Latin America, and what that turn entailed, at its essence, was the acceptance of a long-standing demand. And Latin American lawyers and diplomats and jurists had long been demanding that the United States give up the right to intervention, that they accept what they call the absolute sovereignty in domestic and foreign relations of Latin America. This was an ideal that has deep roots in Latin American, in Spanish American, and Portuguese American political culture, in some ways going back to the colonial period. But it really, in reaction to U.S. militarism and U.S. expansion, a new generation at the end of the 1800s and the early 1900s began to really forcefully demand this what would have been a revision to international law, like the idea of great power diplomacy, and the big powers rule. You wage war if you can, and you take what you can get. And Latin America performed a much more moral vision of what the international order should look like. And the U.S. had long resisted that until it couldn't. And there's a very specific moment. There's the 7th Pan American Conference in Montevideo, Uruguay. It's important. It happens in 1933, and it's in this context in which the U.S. doesn't really have much pull in the rest of the world because of all of those reasons I talked about earlier. So FDR dispatches his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, to go to Montevideo. And he says, basically, you give them whatever they want, give them runway lights so they can land planes at night and promise to build roads, do anything, but don't accept the principle of absolute sovereignty. But Cordell Hull in Montevideo had very little options. I mean, he was basically ganged up on him, and with the United States in this political and economic contraction, Hull conceded to Latin American demands. And it might have been the most successful foreign policy about face in U.S. history, because it didn't lead to a collapse of U.S. power to accept and recognize the absolute sovereignty of a nation, no matter how small, in the internal and external affairs. It actually, that becomes the principle of the United Nations. That becomes the principle, the founding kind of core ideal of liberal multilateralism. In many other ways, Latin America allows Washington to figure out ways to project its power free from the militarism that had been dragging it down in Central America through these multilateral institutions. And then what shorthand is known as the Good Neighbor Policy, a series of alliances and treaties, the creation of the Organization of American States, mutual defense pacts, become the model for what the U.S. puts into place after World War II. And let me just say one more thing. This acceptance of the ideal of non-intervention and absolute sovereignty also allows Cordell Hull to sign a series of free trade agreements. And those free trade agreements, and these are real free trade agreements, not what passes for free trade agreements today, which are basically just institutionalization of corporate monopoly rents and intellectual property rights. These were really kind of opening up markets. That has the effect of strengthening a key corporate base of what becomes the New Deal coalition, this labor-intensive, export-driven, high-tech series of industries, pharmaceuticals, chemical, the energy, sophisticated manufacturing. All of these industries, in exchange for FDR basically opening up foreign markets, begin to support what's called the Second New Deal. Remember, FDR's first New Deal, the National Recovery Act and a series of other, was struck down by the Supreme Court. Social Security, all of these things that we associate with the New Deal is basically what U.S. historians call the Second New Deal. And it only becomes possible because FDR was able to cultivate ties with this key economic sector that wasn't opposed to his expansion of labor rights, for instance, as opposed to the labor extensive industries of textile and, you know, shoemaking and furniture making and all of those that basically stay out of the New Deal coalition. So that's an example of how Latin America helps the New Deal build itself, build its alliances, you know, its economic foundation, and allows this new coalition, a New Deal coalition, to work out its ideas of how the United States could project its power in the world through multilateralism, through institutions, through mutual defense treaties. And it's obviously enormously successful. The New Deal goes on to win World War II. It goes on after World War II to build this multilateral order. The other thing that Latin America is key for is it teaches the United States how to kind of move back and forth between the institutions, universal institutions like the United Nations, and regional institutions. So the United States didn't want to be bound down or tied down by the universalism of the United Nations. It could always appeal to the Organization of American States and obligations of the organization. So that kind of regional treaty alliance system, which the U.S. creates, CETO in Southeast Asia, NATO in Europe, that becomes key to the United States' agility to confront to take on the Soviet Union and maneuver during the Cold War. So Latin America, that's what I mean by Latin America as a workshop, as a training ground, as a way that political coalitions work out their sense of themselves.
I'm speaking with historian Greg Grandin about his book, Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States and the Making of an Imperial Republic, that's recently revised. Greg Grandin is the historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the 1970s marked a moment of great defeat and disarray for the United States following the Vietnam War, following Watergate, as well as a global economic crisis of capitalism, and in many ways an unraveling of that New Deal order that had been put in place in the 1930s. How were interventions into Latin America in the 1980s a response to those crises?
Yes. So Empire's Workshop looks at both the New Deal and then the New Right as the quintessential 20th century political coalitions. And it takes the 1970s and the collapse of the New Deal order around crises such as Vietnam, such as Watergate, such as the general spread of political dissent at home, revelations of the crimes committed by U.S. security forces abroad and against domestic dissent at home, and it looks at the Carter administration as kind of a transitional presidency, giving rise to the Reagan White House, and it looks at Reaganism as a social movement, as a new right political coalition that displaces, that takes over from the New Deal, and in many ways Reagan takes office in 1981, he's elected in 1980, and he runs on a program of restoring U.S. power and moral authority in the world, right? A lot of neoconservative analysts, such as Jean Kirkpatrick, they see the crisis not just as a crisis of power, but a crisis of confidence, right? That Vietnam scrambled the establishment's ability to act in the world with a sense of confidence and assuredness that what it was doing was good. And so Reagan's task and Reaganism's task wasn't just to reassert power, but remoralize power, remoralize militarism, and remoralize markets. And he comes to power in 1981, and there's not a lot of places, again, thinking, you know, this is where there's a similarity with FDR. There's not a lot of places in the world where the U.S. can actually act. The Soviet Union is still in existence. They still have nuclear weapons. The Middle East, the U.S. has made its post-Vietnam turn to the Middle East, but the Middle East is split between in its allegiances between the Soviet Union and the United States. There was the revolution in Iran with the fall of the Shah and the rise of the Islamist State. Africa was also its allegiances were split. In Latin America, most of the rest of South America was locked down under a series of anti-communist dictatorships that the U.S. had supported. I mean, we know about Chile in 1973, but Uruguay in 1973, Bolivia in 71, Paraguay, Argentina in 76. So South America was secure. South America was locked down and was like a garrison continent. But in Central America was in revolt. The Sandinistas had won their revolution in 1979. There were powerful insurgencies in El Salvador and in Nicaragua. And so the Reagan administration uses Central America much the way the Roosevelt administration used Latin America to work out ideas, work out tactics, get a sense of themselves as an aspiring coalition. And one of the arguments of Empire's Workshop is that the importance of Central America resided in its unimportance. It had no nuclear weapons. It was firmly within the U.S.'s sphere of influence. The Soviet Union wasn't going to object. It had clients it could work with and were eager to work with the United States. And so Reagan could give Central America, whether we're talking about the Contra War in Nicaragua or the death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala, to movement conservatives with little fear of consequences. By the way, I'm not the person who identifies Central America as critically important as Gene Kirkpatrick. Sometime around 19, Reagan had named Kirkpatrick ambassador to the UN and elevated that position to a cabinet post. And Kirkpatrick said that that Central America is critically important, the most important region in the world today for the United States. You know, at the time, people had trouble trying to figure out exactly what she meant. I mean, there was no oil. There wasn't a lot going on in Central America. But the argument that I make is that its importance resides in its unimportance. And by what I mean by that, he gave Central America to movement conservatives. He gave Central America to different branches of movement conservatives. Central America becomes the crucible for different constituencies of what would become the coherent new right. So neoconservatives, secular neoconservatives, religious theocons, militarist radicalized by the Vietnam War, radicalized to the right, soldier of fortune type mercenaries, all of these people Reagan basically let loose in Central America and let them run. Central America was the place where Reagan could match word for deed with little fear of consequences. And that experience, I mean, we talk about Nicaragua, and people joke about the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and the importance of Nicaragua for the left as a kind of a pilgrimage site. But, you know, scratch somebody in the new right, and you'll find that they somehow, Eric Prince, for instance, did spend some time, having something to do with the Contra War in Nicaragua.
This is of Blackwater fame.
Yeah, Blackwater fame. So, there was a way in which Central America allows these relations to thicken. And allows contradictions, tensions between secular neoconservatives whose vision of a restoration of American power after Vietnam, wasn't necessarily religious based, but they were able to find alliances and work together with Pentecostals and evangelicals. And key to all of this is liberation theology. liberation theology as the radicalization of the Catholic Church, was powerful in Central America. And the Sandinista Revolution was as much Christian as it was Marxist. Liberation theology was strong in El Salvador. Oscar Romero and his assassination in 1980, the execution of the Jesuits at the end of the decade. It was powerful in Guatemala. So liberation theology becomes the first political religion that unites the new right before they move on to Islam. And why this is important is that it forces the new right to think through the morality of capitalism and militarism, right? It's one thing to be able to just project power. It's another thing to justify it in moral terms. And a lot of the kind of remoralization of markets that we associate with libertarianism, there's a strong component of that was forged an argument against liberation theology. And I go through this in the book to a great degree, where liberation theologians said the market was an amoral site of greed, and that militarism was militarism made life miserable for the world's poor. Evangelical economists arguing directly against liberation theology said that the market was a place that reflected God's grace, that by striving to overcome, you expanded the area of freedom. That militarism was and the strength of the United States was actually a reflection of God's will. So these were all very, and I'm not doing justice to the arguments, but the arguments were made directly in relationship to liberation theology, and so Central America becomes central to this emerging worldview that we generally call Reaganism or neoliberalism.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by Greg Grandin. He's professor of history at Yale University, author of the recently revised Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Making of an Imperial Republic, which we're discussing today. That's published by Picador. He's the author of many books, including Fordlandia, Kissinger's Shadow, and The End of the Myth, which won the Pulitzer Prize. So I wanted to ask you, Greg, about the lessons that were learned in the 1980s and then applied elsewhere, learned in Latin America by this coalition of the U.S. right. And one of the key lessons was around counterinsurgency. I wanted to ask you if you could just give us a short history of U.S. support for counterinsurgency in a place like El Salvador, which precedes the 1980s, but then becomes sort of fully fledged in that period.
Yeah, well, U.S. involvement in a place like El Salvador really takes off after the Cuban Revolution, where the U.S. commits itself to strengthening the word that they often use is professionalize or centralize the intelligence agencies of these allied states, El Salvador being one of them. So in the 1960s, early 1960s, the U.S. Began to create and fortify the security apparatus of El Salvador well before there was an insurgency to counter. El Salvador is a classic place where the counterinsurgency creates the insurgency. A lot of this takes place under the rubric of the Alliance for Progress. And the Alliance for Progress is, of course, John F. Kennedy's developmentalist program for Latin America, which was also a direct response to the Cuban Revolution, where Kennedy was trying to claim Castro's revolutionary thunder. We will complete the revolution of the Americas. But, of course, the Alliance for Progress did promote land reform and tax reform and a certain kind of developmentalist capitalism. But it's a classic example of the good cop, bad cop. At the same time, the Alliance for Progress was promoting land reform, moderate land reform, and some a little bit more just tax structure. It was also arming these militaries and strengthening the intelligence agencies of these countries. So to the point where the reformists that the Alliance for Progress hoped to bolster were being singled out for execution by the death squads that the Alliance for Progress had created. And I think that that's the main dynamic of radicalization in countries. And El Salvador is a classic example of that, where the U.S. Funding supports both the strengthening of the intelligence agency and the strengthening of what becomes a paramilitary network that's feeding off of and using information that's gathered by that intelligence agency. There's a, you know, we think of the word central intelligence agency, that the U.S.'s program or project was to centralize intelligence in all of these countries, but that also meant intelligence that was being fed to death squads and paramilitaries that would single out not just communists and not just people that were, you know, activists that were seen as a threat by the U.S., but all sorts of reformers and activists and Democrats, and there'd be waves of radicalization. And El Salvador, Guatemala, you know, perfect examples of this dynamic that I'm talking about. But yes, El Salvador becomes the place where counterinsurgency is rehabilitated in the 1980s. It's the place where militarists go down, working with the Department of Defense. And basically their argument is, you know, the famous bumper stickers read that El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. And you know, and these Department of Defense military advisors didn't disagree. They thought El Salvador was a place to get the theory right. And by that, they mostly meant preventing a deepening direct involvement, strengthening the security apparatus of the country without increasing the number of U.S. boots on the ground.
So what lessons were drawn from this counterinsurgency against the left in Latin America, in places like El Salvador, places like Nicaragua, places like Colombia, which would later be used by neoconservatives, and of course many of them people who actually cut their teeth in Latin America in the 1980s, in their policies and thinking about the U.S. occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. You know, this is a new edition of a book that I wrote right after the invasion of Iraq, where I was trying to make sense of why all of these Central American hands had come back. Elliot Abrams, Otto Reich, John Poindexter. You know, there was all of these characters from Iran-Contra that all of a sudden assumed a prominent role in the U.S.'s post-9/11 bid to go global, you know, drive into the Persian Gulf. And I was trying to, and that is part of the argument, the way that Latin America allows retrenchment. And then once that retrenchment takes place, then the U.S. then goes global. And then once that going global hits a wall or collapses, then the U.S. turns back to Latin America. That's the larger dynamics of the argument. But yes, a lot of these characters, John Negroponte, who was the ambassador to Honduras, and then where he basically ran death squads, becomes very prominent in the war in Iraq or the disintegration of Iraq is a better way of putting it. But in terms of counterinsurgency, there's a dynamic of counterinsurgency that goes back almost since the inception of the concept, where counterinsurgents are constantly talking about fighting the other war, constantly talking about winning, I mean, to use a phrase associated with Vietnam, winning hearts and minds, or building the state, or building institutional capacity. You know, and the idea is to create a state that is strong enough and capable enough to administer its territory and confront and root out the kind of causes of insurgency. Sometimes this winning of hearts and minds might actually entail some real reform, some real land reform. Other times it's more like window dressing. But the point is, there's this constant talk of the other war. But the fact of the matter is, wherever counterinsurgency has been quote unquote successful in defeating an insurgency, it's usually always just because of a preponderance of power and application of what otherwise would be known as terrorism, just the use of death squads, right? So in El Salvador, for instance, there was a lot of talk about, as I mentioned, getting the theory right. El Salvador was a workshop. It was a laboratory. It was a way to reapply counterinsurgency theory that had been discredited in Vietnam, and but discredited, according to these theorists, for the wrong reasons. It was, you know, the reason why it didn't work in Vietnam is because the U.S. violated the theory and escalated and turned it into a full-on war with boots on the ground. So these theorists said, no, we get a chance for a do-over. We could train the security apparatuses. We could build the state. We can win hearts and minds. We could fight the other war. You know, by the other war, they meant, again, winning hearts and minds, civic action, some kind of political and economic reform. And they talked about this incessantly in El Salvador. But the fact of the matter is that none of that helped defeat the FMLN in El Salvador, or none of that worked to win back territory or win allegiance or strengthen a reformist sector within within the domestic bourgeoisie and the security apparatus that would defend a larger kind of general interest against just out and out terror and out exploitation. None of that happened. What happened is that the bodies mounted. 50,000 disappeared, maybe 70,000 dead. We all know the history of El Salvador. The U.S. spent millions of dollars a day supporting, basically supporting these deaths. The massacre of El Mazote in 1981, in December 1981, and throughout the horrific killings. You know, that ultimately is what at least contained the insurgents in El Salvador and who fought the war to a draw. So it's just an interesting dynamic, this constantly circling back to, well, we have to kind of build the state, we have to fight the other war, but that never happens. You see the same dynamic in Colombia, you see the same dynamic in Afghanistan, you see the same dynamic in Iraq.
Greg Grandin is my guest. He's a historian and the author of Empire's Workshop. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Greg, you're arguing that there's sort of a dialectic that has taken place where the U.S. has attempted to dominate Latin America, and that there has been a pushback both by, you know, movements from below and also from Latin American elites, which has had surprisingly beneficial consequences for the United States, as it has forced it to refine U.S. hegemony as it's projected onto the rest of the world. And yet you also argue that for elites in the U.S., there's a constant tension there because, of course, they would like to dominate without having to refine their domination. But one place where that pushback seems to have led to a different sort of dynamic has been the wave, that often called the pink tide, of elections in the 2000s, by 2008. A whole number of left-leaning governments had come to power in Latin America. The fates of those governments, I think we could discuss separately, but I wanted to ask you how that changed the landscape of politics in Latin America, and to what degree did it interrupt this tried and true pattern of the U.S. turning to Latin America when its imperial ambitions had created crises elsewhere?
Yeah, well, it's a perfect example of what I'm arguing, but then also how the conditions have changed, where the argument, in some ways, that dynamic no longer holds. The U.S. regrouped in Central America. The new right came to power, formed a governing coalition, which continued on under Clinton, and certainly under George W. Bush after 9/11. I mean, it goes global. It goes global first economically under Clinton in terms of globalization, all free trade agreements and attempts to institutionalize a kind of supranational neoliberal order. And then it goes global militarily after 9/11, which George W. Bush. And then, of course, that going global collapses, right? It that coalition reaches its endpoint. It becomes exhausted. Domestically, austerity and tax cuts and the gutting of the New Deal state had led to a degree of polarization and misery that could no longer be ignored. And in terms of foreign policy, neoliberalism reached its endpoint. That people could pick whatever moment that neoliberalism as a global economic strategy collapsed. I mean, maybe with the Asian crisis, maybe with the rise of the pink tide, certainly in 2007, 2008, but at some point it collapses. So the two kind of twin pillars of the new right coalition are no longer, are crumbling. They're crumbling, right? So the over military overreach in the Persian Gulf and pushing neoliberalism to the extreme led to its collapse. So the U.S. could have turned back. It's always a little difficult talking in hypotheticals, but the Obama administration, if we want to look at the Obama administration as a missed opportunity, which I think is now coalescing as a certain kind of common sense, even among Democrats and liberals, it certainly was a missed opportunity in Latin America. I mean, there was a moment when Latin America, as you mentioned, with the rise of the pink tide, starting with Chavez in Venezuela and then continuing with Lula in Brazil and Kirchner in Argentina and so on, was governed by every historic tendency of the Latin American left. At one point, you had a trade unionist in power in Brazil, a military populist in power in Venezuela, a feminist doctor in Argentina, in Chile. You had a new left guerrilla in Uruguay. You had a peasant indigenous activist in Bolivia. You had a liberation theologian in Paraguay. I mean, the whole slate, it was like a panorama, like a historic panorama. And when Obama was elected, and this was all on the eve of, they were eager to welcome him into the pantheon. I mean, I think Lula, maybe it was Chavez or Lula, I think it was Lula who said, he's the fulfillment of the U.S. progressive history, the culmination of the civil rights movement. But what did the Obama administration do? It basically endorsed a coup in Honduras, the first kind of turning point against the pink tide, against the new, return of the new left. It allowed a coup in Paraguay. It was active in supporting the corruption investigation against Lula in Dilma in Brazil. And of course, it did everything it could to isolate Chavez in terms of its energy policy with the expansion of fracking and natural gas and turning the United States into an energy exporter, which led to the collapse of oil prices and led to the containment of Venezuela. So it's a hypothetical. It's hard to say what Obama could have done, but he could have done things. He could have pushed more actively for immigration reform rather than doing that kind of devil's bargain of trying to win over the military, the border brutalists first. He could have passed. He could have worked with Lula to work out a new framework for intellectual property rights around pharmaceuticals. An issue that certainly is in the news today. He could have worked with Latin American New Left like FDR did to put into place a kind of new economic order, a political order that would have had popular support, that could have been an alternative to the rise of what we now see, the authoritarian neoliberal right. And he didn't. He didn't for a lot of ways. You know, I wrote about this in The Nation, where if you go back and you look at his comments about the overthrow of Lugo in Paraguay, and then the impeachment of Dilma, and the jailing of Lula in Brazil, the words that he used to describe those are the exact same tone that he uses to describe the election of Donald Trump. Basically, the institutions are strong. We trust democracy. It really was a kind of missed opportunity. But okay, let's bracket that, because there's a lot to be said about Obama. But let's jump ahead to Trump. Trump couldn't take advantage of allies in Latin America either. I mean, he had Duque in Colombia, he had Bolsonaro in Brazil, and he flailed in Latin America too. So I think, and this is an argument I make in the new epilogue to the book, is that dynamic in which Latin America serves as a workshop for the United States for ascending political coalitions actually no longer holds. Because what is happening is the United States is exporting its own extremism. So you look at Bolivia, you look at Brazil, and what you see are libertarians. What you see are the power of the National Rifle Association. What you see are Pentecostals. What you see is a certain kind of Trumpism. You know, in Bolsonaro's an example of Trumpism on steroids, and that doesn't actually create the conditions for using Latin America as a training ground, right? I think it's a marker of the centrifugal forces that are pulling the United States apart. Put a long story short, is I think that the conditions have changed, and there no longer can aspiring political coalitions in the United States use Latin America as a kind of way to coalesce themselves. That's over. I don't know what the alternative is. Maybe it's just ongoing polarization and disaggregation. That would be my guess. Cycles of partial reform followed by cycles of more extreme reaction. But I don't think we'll see another kind of political coalition that's able to mobilize Latin America the way the New Deal and the New Right did.
Well, let me end by asking you then, if you can make a judgment about that state of affairs. I mean, you write about, and you've just spoken about, the emergence of all sorts of really fringe right-wing tendencies in the United States, now in Latin America, including QAnon. If the United States no longer is using Latin America as its crucible, as its workshop, is that of benefit to social movements in the left? I mean, one presumes that it would be. Or do you think that the terrain has been changed so much by these elements of the right inside Latin America that it makes things less auspicious than it would otherwise be?
It's a good question. I don't know what the answer is. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, As Joe and Lai said when asked about the French Revolution, it's too early to tell, but it's too early to say. You know, I don't know. I mean, one would think, on the one hand, that the disaggregation of the United States would create a space in which Latin America could chart its own path. On the other hand, the exportation of extremism has been intense, and we see this nowhere better than in Brazil with Bolsonaro. I mean, Bolsonaro's son has a shrine. I mean, Bolsonaro talks about the Second Amendment as if the Brazilian Constitution has a Second Amendment guaranteeing gun rights, but of course it doesn't, because it's a different constitution. But the rise of QAnon, the crazy obsession about gender and critical race theory. And
I think many listeners would be surprised to know that Judith Butler, the gender theorist at UC Berkeley, is a prominent target of the Latin American target and obsession.
Yeah, obsession in Colombia and Brazil. Yeah, she's an obsession. And the way all of this kind of collapses into each other, I'm as critical as the U.S. empire and U.S. foreign policy as anybody, but one has to acknowledge that the fact that one of the reasons why the U.S., why Latin America has had no interstate wars, significant interstate wars since the 1930s, is because the United States administered the region as a single region for the most part. If any country tried to break out Guatemala, Chile, Cuba, the U.S. would bring it to heel or isolate it. But for the most part, the U.S. didn't play off one region off of another. You know, that's changed. You know, the United States is much, Washington is totally willing, as its power recedes, to play off, you know, depending on, you know, you use Colombia as you know, much the way it uses Israel in the Middle East as a proxy for kind of hard line and to project militarism outward to countries that might be trying to forge an independent path. So I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. On the one hand, there's still a lot of inspiration. I mean, you look at the social movements in Chile that just managed to force the state to accept the need for a constitutional referendum to do away with the constitution that was put into place by Pinochet. You look at the protests in Colombia. You look at the resilience of an ideal of social democracy and social rights in Latin America. And one has to be inspired, the deep sense of history, among social movements. But on the other hand, the forces of reaction, not only are they powerful, they're unhinged, much as they are in the United States. I think that in some ways the relationship between any kind of economic logic or political logic has been severed from the actions and ideas of the right, which is always a scary moment.
Indeed. Greg Randon has been my guest. We've been discussing his book, Empire's Workshop, which has been recently revised. Subtitle is Latin America, the United States, and the Making of an Imperial Republic. That book is published by Picador, and you can find a link to it at againstthegrain.org. Greg Randon is the author of many books, including Fordlandia, The End of the Myth, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize, and Kissinger's Shadow, and he teaches history at Yale University. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.